So a few words of introduction, why it can be refreshing to look at Aquinas on human emotions. Around the year 2000, I forget whether it was before or after, the government paid for some adverts on television about 9 p.m. encouraging teenagers to have safe sex. And we were treated to clips of rhinoceroses copulating and swans courting. And a voiceover in a Scottish accent said, "They don't have emotions, they don't make commitments, you're different." And I thought, but some animals do make commitments. And if you've had a pet or worked on a farm, you know perfectly well that they have emotions. And then around the same time, there were a few newspaper headlines saying, with some surprise, "Scientists have proved that animals are conscious." And I thought, but Thomas Aquinas knew they were conscious in the 13th century, and Aristotle knew it in the 3rd century BC. So there is a myth around that emotions and consciousness are peculiar to human beings. And clearly those are myths, and some people find the busting of those myths a bit disturbing. We know that a large part of human psychology is animal psychology, and animals, at least the higher animals, have lots of similarities to us. Why should that be surprising? And I think it's because for some centuries, many people have supposed that the human body and animals are just machines. I mean, that goes back, fairly or unfairly, to Descartes, who explicitly suggested that the human body and the animal body are hydraulic machines. But the human being has a soul which uses the pineal gland, which he thought was unique to human beings, as a kind of steering column to guide the body. And the completely out-of-date picture of atoms as little kind of solar systems with ball bearings moving according to classical mechanics, that out-of-date picture, I think, stays in some people's minds to make it seem that the body is just a machine, a deterministic machine, and consciousness emerges with a certain degree of complexity. So it can be frightening to people to recognize that animals are conscious, and we share some psychology with them. And if you think that personhood is very much tied to consciousness and the use of language, then you might begin to wonder, as some modern ethicists do — I've got some false teeth and I've begun to lisp — some modern ethical thinkers propose that some higher animals might be more personal than some human beings, people in the coma or unborn children, and so on. So it can be refreshing to go back to someone like St. Thomas Aquinas, who knew less than we do, much less than we do, about brain structure and functioning, and knew a bit less about animal psychology. He wouldn't have known about the social life of great apes. But he did know, perhaps better than many more recent philosophers, how complex animal psychology is. And he was not afraid of the animal component, so to speak, of human psychology. And that meshed with the very powerful body of ethics in his writings, and with a profound sense, philosophical and theological, of the dignity and distinctiveness of the human being. So he provides a kind of model for holding together truths that sometimes seem to be in tension with each other. Unlike his teacher, St. Albert, I don't think Thomas bothered to look at animals or the natural world. He would have gone around with his head down thinking. Albert stopped to ask fishermen what kind of noise the fish made when mating, and so on. He kept a pet dog with odd-coloured eyes and got his pet snake drunk on one occasion. Thomas didn't do any of that. But by a sympathetic reading of Aristotle and Arabic philosophers like Avicenna, he did have a profound sense of the complexity of the animal and the human psyche. So I want to say something this evening about that, but start with a few minutes on what I mean by psyche. It's a modern word. Psychology comes from it, but psuche is the Greek word we translate as soul, anima in Latin. And after Descartes, many people think only human beings have souls, and they are a kind of little angel running the body like the soldier driving the tank. But for St. Thomas, following Aristotle, a soul is the fundamental principle of life in the living things around us. Angels are alive, they don't have souls. But for plants and animals and human beings, the soul is effectively a form of life or a pattern of life. Not a spiritual bit of us, but it's the whole form of life. So of course plants and animals have souls by definition, because they are animate, but each has its own kind of soul. And Aristotle himself taught us not to think of the soul as a kind of mere structure in the way that a bicycle or a computer is just a structured machine, the sum of its parts. That's an artificial whole. But for St. Thomas and for Aristotle, an organism is a single being, more than the sum of its parts. And one sign of that is that if you were to cut off my hand, it wouldn't be a hand anymore. It wouldn't do what hands do. It can only be a hand within the whole living being. And it would take several hours, indeed several research projects, to explore how this picture of the soul might in fact be better than Descartes' picture at capturing elements of modern science. But for the time being, we must just think of the soul as forming the whole living body in a deep and pervasive way. Obviously, incorporating the elements that have come in through food and so on, but responsible for the whole structure and functioning of the single organic body. And so for St. Thomas, there are degrees of soul, degrees of life. He wouldn't be surprised by viruses which are kind of half alive, less alive than bacteria. But he saw a kind of gradation anyway. So the form of wood is simply making this lectern be wood. It's tied down in space and time. And if I were to saw it in half, each bit would be wood in the same sense. But a plant has greater unity. It functions as a single living thing, and it begins to transcend mere materiality. On the table that I've given you at the lowest level, we have Thomas's claim that the soul, the form of life that a plant is, will, so to speak, deploy itself in the ability to take in nourishment from outside, to grow to a maturity, and to reproduce for the future. Plants already really rather exciting. They have a certain degree of unity, but it's a moderate degree of unity. You can often split a plant in two, especially if you have green fingers, and grow two plants. And animals, especially the higher animals, have more unity, and they defend it more vigorously and viciously. And their life transcends materiality even more. So the middle level of your table shows that at least the higher animals have a complex sense life. Stick to the column labelled perceptive at the moment. For St. Thomas, following people like Avicenna, animals can receive sense data and also coordinate it. The cat can tell that the brown thing that is moving is the thing that is smelling mousy and enticing it to pounce. It doesn't just tell that this is one mouse that it is sensing in various ways. It interprets the mouse as food, just as the sheep can interpret the wolf as danger. So animals can interpret their environment in quite subtle ways. And they can learn, probably learn rather more than St. Thomas thought they could learn. The cat can learn that if it goes to Mrs. Blogg's house and rubs around her legs, it will get lots of titbits. Thomas recognised elements of particular reasoning in animals. If some hunting dogs are pursuing their quarry on a path in the forest and the path forks, if they go down one path and sniff and don't smell the quarry, they straight away go down the next path without having to sniff again. They can tell if it's not that path, it's that one. Thomas recognises the subtle psyche, the complex interpretation and interaction with their environment that you find in animals. We'd expect an emotional life. And human beings live at a higher level which incorporates and transcends the lower levels. So we have, in our own way, the vegetative powers. We have, in a more subtle way, the sensitive powers. We can interpret our environment, coordinate our sense data, tell all sorts of things about what's going on around us in a more agile and more imaginative way than the other animals. And there's probably more instinct in us than St. Thomas recognised, but he recognised at least elements of temperament. But we also have intellect. We can rise even further above mere materiality to form what you might call abstract or universal concepts. We can both recognize food and ask what food is, recognize other animals and ask what their natures are. The cat can cope with several gardens, and remembering that Mr. Smith will kick it and Mrs. Bloggs will feed it. We can write books with titles like The First 3 Minutes. So as Augustine put it, while the cosmos contains the human body, the human mind can contain the cosmos. And our life, our questioning, our language, our social interactions aren't circumscribed in the way that they are with other, even complex animals. And of course, all of that could take hours and hours to explore further. So St. Thomas thinks that the intellect, being able to hold concepts that abstract from material conditions, is not tied down to materiality. I can sense with my hand things which are present. My intellect can range much more widely, universally. But I'm a single organism with a single life. My intellect, my reasoning, can only work in cooperation with the imagination. When we actively think, rather than just hold concepts, we need pictures and diagrams and examples and illustrations and language spoken or written, or at least imagined. So for Thomas, brain injury, drugs, sleep, abject terror, all sorts of things can impede thinking. And so consciousness is not as big a deal for Thomas as it is for many modern philosophers, because other animals are conscious, and we are conscious some of the time in varying ways. Focusing on one thing distracts you from other things. But all human beings have a nature from which reasoning naturally emerges, even if something like extreme youth or brain injury can impede the exercise of reason. So that's the complexity of the perception and interpretation of the world. If you perceive and interpret the world, you will react to it. Anything that can perceive, that can grasp something of the meaning of the things around it, will react. Will react towards what is suitable and pleasing to it, and recoil from what is destructive, unpleasant in various ways. And so we come to what you might call emotions. Emotion is a modern term, and it's often quite complex and context specific. We would talk about the kind of emotions that are aroused in a quarrel with your boss in the office or in courtship, in all sorts of departments of life. And Thomas approaches the same material in a different way. He speaks of the passiones animae, the passions of the soul. But that's not a helpful English word because they aren't all passionate. So emotion might kind of do, but it's not exactly what we mean by emotion today. And it's at a first level of analysis that passions, emotions of the soul, and also the human will, are responsive faculties, responding to the good or evil that we perceive. Ever since 1277, there's a specific date when the Archbishop of Paris and the Archbishop of Canterbury condemned certain Aristotelian propositions and changed the whole history of Western thought. That's a bit broad brush, but anyway. Many people think of the will as the kind of arbitrary power that hangs above a world of choices and says, I'll have that one today. And it can be very refreshing to think back behind that watershed to the picture held by St. Thomas or St. Bonaventure or St. Augustine, that the will and the emotions are the ability to be attracted by the good. And the importance of the emotions is partly because it is through them, which, of course, they have a bodily component, through them we are able to move and do things. They mediate in some ways between the will and the bodily movements. So what St. Thomas does with the emotions, with these reactions that animals and we have to our environment, is look at the basic patterns of attraction and repulsion that happen in animal or human life. And he divides, as I've listed here and on the other handout, he divides the emotions into two groups, the concupiscible emotions and the irascible emotions. And examples will make that kind of thing fairly clear. The concupiscible emotions are the kind of everyday patterns of like and dislike, pursuit and avoidance. So, I love, as a general disposition, I love candied orange peel in dark chocolate, for example, or Polish plum stuffed with marzipan coated with dark chocolate. And if you were to give me a present of them, then I would desire to eat them. If I were really virtuous, I would desire to share them, but I teach a course on virtue because those that can do and those that can't teach. So I would desire to eat them and derive pleasure from eating them. So love, desire, pleasure. That's a pattern of approach to the things that please us and ideally are suitable to us. If, on the other hand, you invited me to supper and put tripe on the table, I have a hatred of tripe and of haggis, black pudding, faggots, andouillette, cutichino, spider abdomens, witchetty grubs, and a few other things that I list on dietary requirement sheets. So I have a general hatred of tripe. If it were in front of me, I would feel an aversion. And if I had to eat it, there'd be a great sadness, pain, suffering, etc. So there's that pattern of positive and negative emotions. But then there are challenging situations that arise in our life in the world. So, for example, if I'm walking along the side of a field and there's a nasty thorn hedge to my right, then my dislike of being scratched just keeps me going to the gate, which I can see. But then a bull comes charging at me with its horns down, and that arouses, that challenging situation arouses new emotions, the irascible emotions. And I can see a way out of the danger of the bull by pushing my way through the hedge. So I have an emotion of hope, which gives me the courage to force my way through the hedge, not minding being scratched. There can be that conflict among the irascible and concupiscible emotions. And there might be an element of anger as I make my way through the hedge, but I make my way through the hedge and then relax in safety. If it were a 20-foot-high wall with no finger holds, then I wouldn't feel hope but despair. There'd be that emotion of despair at my predicament. And I would be afraid. Afraid of being gored by the bull. And as it approaches, there would be a flash of anger at this evil coming upon me, which hopefully would help me punch it in the eye and escape. So there are patterns of reaction to the situations we are in. Complex patterns, and quite possibly many of us have felt some of those emotions in ways that wouldn't be at all very different from the way a complex animal would feel desire for food, aversion to table scraps if you've learnt to love whiskers, hope and courage when escaping from enemies, from predators. Animals get angry when they are cornered and there's no way out. The same thing can happen to us. So this analysis of the emotions looks at patterns that come up in many different situations rather than analysing particular kinds of situation, like courtship or rows in the office, setting off on holiday, etc., etc. For all of those, Thomas will talk about the relevant virtues that should be used and the vices that might be employed in different situations. But this analysis of the emotions is a bit more abstract, but we can see that it's the kind of thing that does go on. So, the passiones animae are complex. There can be tension, perhaps conflict among them. And while they are, in a sense, responses, they lead often enough to energetic action. And the human being has all of these, but in a more subtle way still, a more agile way, a more sensitive way than the other animals. because in us there's not just intellect, there's also will. Human beings have a will at the same level, more or less, as the intellect. And the will is, for Thomas, a rational appetite, the ability to be attracted by the good that reason perceives. So Thomas associates our freedom not with any arbitrariness, but with the way in which our thinking is open-ended. I was thinking earlier today about what to say and how to say it, and I could have gone down the road of saying to myself, I don't want to do this. I'll go off to the cinema and they can do without me. I could have thought about the good of the cinema in preference to the greater good of giving a talk to you. And when I was thinking about how to come here, I could have thought, as I did, I will come with Lawrence, who knows the way better. I could have thought, I'll get a taxi as more comfortable, I'll get the underground as more under my control, because I have a nice map of the underground and I'm not sure where the buses are going. We can think in different ways and see things as good to greater or lesser extent. And the will is our ability to be attracted by the good that we perceive by reason. But just as the intellect has to work in organic cooperation with the imagination, so the human will works in principle in cooperation with the passiones animae. It is largely through them that we decide, that we are able to move as we decide. But the rational part of us has what Thomas calls, what Aristotle calls, a political government of the emotions. The will can despotically decide, I will move my hand, and my hand moves, unless there's something physically wrong. But I can't despotically decide what emotions to feel. I can, by reason and will, work up and suppress emotions, but I can't control them completely because of their connection with the imagination and the environment and bodily changes I'm not conscious of. We can, and sometimes need to, make ourselves angry or suppress anger. We might work up or suppress a desire or aversion. We can control our emotions to some extent, but not, so to speak, rigidly and despotically. So working on our emotions is not necessarily a sign that something is wrong. We sometimes naturally have to make an effort to suppress the emotion of fear, say going to the dentist and knowing there's going to be an unpleasant injection before the treatment begins. We can suppress the desire for food if we want to fast for religious or political motives, and so on. With reason we can see goods that the senses can't perceive, and have to control our emotions. So the Stoics thought that emotions, the passions of soul, were just bad. Aristotle says they are in principle good, and Thomas sides with Aristotle. They are part of the proper functioning of the human being. And an emotional component can enhance human behaviour and make us more free. That's a bit surprising, but if freedom is a matter of ownership of our actions, being able to do wholeheartedly what is really good for us, then if reason and will and emotion working together can issue in some action, we are putting more of ourselves into that action than if we have to grit our teeth and force ourselves to do something we find unpleasant. That might even be the case with Aristotle's example of courage, which is going bravely into battle. Those who are soldiers might find a kind of exhilaration in going into battle, despite all the dangers and hardships. So for Thomas, it's good to be sensitive and emotional. It would be wrong in human to think we ought to be angels with no sensitive or emotional component to our lives. In principle, the emotions are to enhance our life. But we need to bring together reason and emotion. We need to build up virtue. And that word virtue can have the wrong vibes nowadays. It's better to think of it as moral integrity and strength of character. Something attractive. Something vibrant. So for Aristotle and for St. Thomas, if we can bring together the appetites, the will and the emotions with reason, then the emotions won't outstrip reason in an unhelpful way or resist well-judged action. And we will have that extra vibrancy and wholeheartedness that I mentioned. But in a fallen world where we are subject to some disintegration, then building up virtue requires effort, practice, training, help from friends, and of course God's healing grace, which tends to work tactfully, patiently and gently. And so, while the emotions are in a sense receptive, responsive faculties, when formed by virtue, they become more proactive, and they help us, by a kind of second nature, go down wholeheartedly the good road. And so, St. Thomas spends a huge amount of his moral theology in the Prima Secundae talking about how these 11 emotions work and how to manage them. So I've given you a couple of texts which show that his physiology is out of date. He thinks the disposition to anger that some people have is due to having too much bile. And he thinks that anger produces hot blood around the heart, and that's out of date. But the observations of what happens in anger are not out of date. He explains the kind of things that do happen to people who are temperamentally angry or who get angry. And it begins to emerge that sometimes bad emotions aren't really our fault. There might be something wrong with our physiology that makes us prone to anger or alcoholism or whatever. But we need to learn to manage that. And Thomas would not be averse to anger management courses. And so item two of that passage points out how the management of passions is not simply pull yourself together and practice virtue. You might need something more down to earth and practical to deal with emotions. So if you are suffering from tristitsia, sadness, dolor, pain, sorrow, anguish, grief, ache, and so on, what can you do about it? And it's not, Thomas's answer is not, pull yourself together, but there might be some legitimate pleasures that you can indulge in as a remedy to sadness. Obviously, there are some illegitimate pleasures, like drinking too much. You might have a good weep. You might seek the sympathy of a friend. And it's interesting that Thomas is a bit cool about Aristotle here. Because Aristotle offers two reasons why the sympathy of a friend can unburden us of grief. If we see others saddened by our sorrow, it seems that they are bearing the burden with us. But Thomas thinks that's not very good, to want other people to feel your sorrow and be saddened themselves. It's much better to say, when your friends condole with you, you see that you are loved by them, and that brings a pleasure. You might contemplate divine things, at least if you're a saint, and you might have a good sleep or a hot bath. And if Thomas knew that some depression is caused by a chemical imbalance in the brain, then he would say, take the right drugs. So that's a glimpse of something of the complexity and the need to manage, but the potential benefit of the emotions in the human moral life. For Thomas, our human and Christian moral progress is realistic. It's embedded in the realities of human life, including the animal component. And so Thomas seems to me to want to be true to the human reality. He would not be afraid of modern psychological and neurophysiological discoveries. He can help us or inspire us to dialogue with psychology and neurophysiology. But we've seen that he can also provoke interesting questions and trains of thought about the nature of the intellect and the will, human freedom and its limitations, human personhood and dignity. And he can help our ethical reflection be realistic and empathetic rather than impatient with humanity, with this human material. so that's more than enough for me. I must suppress the emotion of boredom and let you have some reaction to me. Thank you.
What would St. Thomas say about, what would he tell us about the recent developments in artificial intelligence? Would he say that robots, which are functionally identical to function of human mind and human organism, have some kind of self?
That's a very interesting question. And until recently, I would have said that you can distinguish between a machine and an organism. The computer, the robot, is a machine. The transistors or whatever in it do what they do, whether they're in the robot or the computer or outside. Just like a cog in a bicycle is itself, whether it's in the bicycle or outside. Whereas in an organism, there's a much greater degree of unity, and the parts are doing what they do as part of the life of the whole. So Herbert McCabe used to like to say, I might use my eye and my brain to see, but it's the whole human being that sees. But we are now moving towards, perhaps, quantum computers. And I've begun to wonder whether something Thomas could not have imagined, you might get some very subtle kind of computer which works much more as one through the way in which the electrons operate in the whole system. And I wonder if then you would have something that's more akin to a virus, where it's halfway between non-living and living. So I wonder, I think there are research projects here, but I wonder whether we might be getting to the stage where we can assemble what would be, in fact, lowly forms of life, where the whole thing, because of its quantum subtlety, so to speak, works as a single organism. I wouldn't want to rule that out. But I wouldn't really want to call that intelligence in the literal sense, because human intelligence is a much higher level. And basically, computers and robots do what we program them to do. And if, by some kind of science fiction imagination, they began to reproduce themselves, I don't think they would evolve into human beings or anything even like a gorilla, chimpanzee, cat or dog. So I think we do still need to have that sense of a hierarchy of living things. And if there were artificial life, it would be very low down the scale. And the complexity of the human brain, the most complex thing in the whole cosmos, does support a spiritual intelligence which can rise above materiality. And I don't think a computer or a robot would be doing that. But that's a very speculative answer, because I think it is a cutting-edge question.
I just wonder about the relationship between language and being open to God, as to whether, if your table is run, whether it is the development of social language that allows you to be open to God, and whether, as it were, if it turned out that, whether some degree of whether that would mean that they were taking a relationship or not. But there is our suggestion, at least in scripture, and I think it comes before them, that they think the animals pray. And they didn't mean the higher animals.
Yes, there's some. I think Tertullian, or is it Cyprian, speaks of the animals praying in the way that they do. When they wake up, they bellow to God, and so on. I think that's more poetic than meant to be literal. But Thomas would agree that all things in the cosmos glorify God by flourishing. So the cosmos, everything in the cosmos is made to flourish in itself for its own good, to be part of a home for the human being, to beautify the whole cosmos and to glorify God. And they're all compatible with each other. But language is extremely interesting, because the kind of language that we have is unique to us. I mean, obviously some chimpanzees, in a kind of parasitic way, use human language, but not in a way that makes them mesh with us. In fact, dogs and horses mesh with human beings much better than bad-tempered chimpanzees. But human language is natural to human beings. And it does have that interesting feature where universal meanings are, so to speak, incarnate in stuff that the imagination holds. So the concept of cat is, so to speak, incarnate in the word cat in English, or chat in French, or kot in Polish. And we bring together the imaginative and the conceptual in actual speaking. And Thomas begins to explore how the structure of language meshes, but not in a neat one-to-one way, with the structure of thought. So language does go with having that openness to abstract concepts that the intellect has. And that's a kind of infinite openness. Too strong a light will damage the eye, whereas powerful concepts will strengthen the intellect. And so there's a natural openness in us to God by intellect and will. They are naturally attracted to the true and the good, and so to God. So there is that interesting connection between our kind of language and our kind of openness to God.
What does Thomas say about motivation? Is motivation part of will, intellectual aspects, and how does it work?
Yes. Yes, so for Thomas, motivation is a huge part, basically, of the will. The emotions pursue goals. Animals have goals and purposes, which is to flourish. But we are able, with our intellect, to perceive the good and be attracted by it. And unlike some later philosophers, having motives makes us more free. I mean, if I go into the cake shop and toss a coin, then I don't make a free choice. Whereas if I go in thinking I really want some Battenberg, and it's there, I make a free choice. Motives contribute to our rational pursuit of goals. And Thomas, at least in principle, thinks there's a kind of hierarchy of goals. You can't help but want to be happy. So the will has an automatic attraction to happiness. But then, as you come down the scale, there's an interaction between thinking and desiring. You have to decide what really makes you happy. Is it political power? Is it God? And moving down from there, how would you get to this source of your happiness and so on? So there's a very strong interaction between thinking and loving in the process, often an implicit process and sometimes explicit. So motivation is a huge part, but it leads us to reflect on how free decision is an interaction between thinking and willing.
You've talked about how the body and soul are joined together. It's not like a soldier driving a tank, at least when we're alive. But when a person is dead, what qualities can we attribute to the disembodied soul that would be different from the qualities we would attribute to the embodied soul?
So if we only had human nature, then the disembodied soul would have a rather poor existence, like the old Hebrew concept of Sheol or the Greek Hades, because intellect and will in themselves don't need a bodily organ, because they are for the true and the good, not this truth or that good. But they work in cooperation with imagination, which is located in the brain, and emotions. So most of human life can't be carried on after death, and the disembodied soul by itself, though indestructible, doesn't have much to look forward to. So you have to bring in God's grace and providence, and build up a picture that after death, either you are drawn into the vision of God, which surpasses all natural powers, maybe through purgatory, maybe directly, and then, in one sense, you are fulfilled by grasping God with mind and will. So it's not a human being that's saved until the resurrection of the body, and then a whole human being is saved. And God will let us know at least some things about the people we have left behind, and we can pray for them and so on. Or if you die hating God, then you end up with a positive punishment in Thomas's picture. So he thinks that the disembodied soul, at least of the, well, probably everyone's disembodied soul, can communicate with the angels. But he makes a kind of maybe too quick a jump, I think, to that, without bringing out how this is by God's providence rather than by any natural power. So I think there's maybe another doctorate there to look, if you want to do a doctorate on the subject.